Welcome back to Game of Thrones 2 Electric Boogaloo. I'm your host, Anthony. This week, Steve and I talk about Eastwatch. This is the episode where Bronn pulls Jaime from the river. Sam explains to Gilly what an annulment is. And Davos visits every city in Westeros in a single episode. After Steve and I discuss this episode, I'll include a short clip of my conversation with my friend Arthur Jomfa. Okay, without further ado, here is comic Steve Osborne. So there's a couple things that I really liked about this episode. I laughed out loud a couple times. Really great parts. But the first thing I wanted to ask you was, I want to ask you about this scene where Tyrion's walking through the battlefield.
Yeah.
Because that sounded that scene looked a lot like your dream.
Yeah, it really did. That was kind of a bizarre moment for me.
Because it's like, it's all ash. It just looks like it's a total burnt out rubble heap, right?
Yeah.
And he's just kind of walking haphazardly through it, just viewing the horrors of war. And I thought, I didn't actually remember that scene, but watching it this time, I was like, oh, Steve dreamed this.
Exactly. Yeah, there's just no Jason Bateman. As far as I could tell.
That you know.
I could do a rewatch. Well, and I liked it for several reasons. Because there is, like I said, like the horrors of war is walking through it. There's the sense of, well, these are the people that I fought for at one point. And also, it's like the romance of the dragons met the reality of the carnage.
Yeah, right. Yeah. And you saw that with where Drogon's kind of up on this little hill and the lighting is really low. And you actually see like the sun shining behind Drogon. It's just beautiful. It's a beautifully shot scene with some amazing CGI, right?
Right.
So you're right. So it's kind of like the romance of this fantasy world. There's the dragon. And then what's going to happen right after that is that Dany is going to go full Dracarys on Tarly and Tarly Jr., right?
Yeah.
We're getting a little bit more of that. Like, the romance of the dragon is almost giving way to the carnage, the reality of the carnage of the dragon.
Because I think it almost feels on some level that there was kind of a hope that you have your cake and eat it too, right? We've got the dragons, but we don't have to unleash the dragons. The threat of the dragon should be enough.
Yeah.
And then he sees it and he's like, and then like even when Jaime, because I mean, Jaime's reaction is great. I really think that's, Jaime has the reaction that we've all been kind of saying, like, well, Dany just seems unstoppable if she's got dragons and Dothraki and all this stuff. And then Jaime sees it firsthand and is like, yeah, you know what? Your scorpion crossbow thing, real cute.
Yeah.
It's real cute. You have to hit that thing square in between the eyes or you're dead. Or you're all dead.
If you were Cersei, you'd be making like 1,000 of those.
Right. That's the other thing is you just have a bunch of them and you just,
fire them all. John and Dany and company, they are taking their sweet time. You know?
Well, apparently.
Bronn and Jaime somehow floated down river.
Yeah.
And far enough away from the battle so that no one saw them go down river.
Right. In armor.
I mean, Jaime had a lot of mud on him. At least they did that part of it, but
yeah.
I mean, immediately it was sort of like, wait a second. I don't know. How much of this did you kind of, how much of this deterred from your enjoyment of the episode?
Not a bunch, but it was definitely one where, I mean, again, the last episode was so great.
Yeah,
exactly. And you do run into, a lot of times those episodes that are really great are like the episode 9, followed by a 10 that may not have as much action, but right. It has something super tense and exciting. So you can kind of ride that wave. This was a little bit more of an abrupt end shift. Yeah. There were many more moments where I was like, and I don't like that because then that takes you away from from just the raw enjoyment of it.
Yeah, for me, it was like a little bit like, how'd they get downriver? How'd no one see them?
And that's
how,
right
how
out the gate.
How'd they survive at all?
Right out the and gate, then, that's the case.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, okay, so we're setting a tone going, oh, they're just out. Oh, all right.
And then I get to hear Jamie and Bronn kind of have this little banter, and I kind of feel like, I'm fine. I get to hear Bronn and Jamie have banter a little bit, and so I'm enjoying this. I'll kind of forget the rest of that stuff. Just don't remind me that you fast-forward people down the river again this episode, and I'll be fine. I started this episode thinking, you know what? I'm just gonna enjoy it. I'm just gonna enjoy the show. I'm not gonna let my sentinel mind ruin this for me.
Mm-hmm.
And guess what?
It didn't. You weren't able to thwart it.
I wasn't able to hold off my critical thinking skills.
Because you know what is to come, and you're looking.
No, specifically about this episode. Not any endgame issues. My issues for this episode were a lot of the fast forward button things.
Oh, okay. Right? And this is, I will be honest, this is the first, we've talked about this a few episodes, and I've not been having the same issue that you have. I mean, I acknowledge them, but I don't have it felt the, I didn't feel the same. Like, I'm like, yeah, no, I mean, I kind of was okay with the pacing because it was sort of mirroring my own sense of urgency. This episode, it was a little more stark for me that,
I think that you could call it a pacing issue, but there's also some plot issues that I really have problems with, and I won't belabor them. I mean, I don't think people want to hear me go on and on.
But we just go right from, like, we see Bronn saves Jamie, and then the next time we see Bronn, he's brokered a meeting with Tyrion. It's like, well, when did this and how and what?
how'd they get that done so fast?
Right, and then he's just like, all right, he's up on shore, and it's like...
Well, I mean, if you just follow Davos... Like, where's Davos,
what a Davos
in this episode?
Heavy episode, man.
Davos is on Dragonstone,
mm-hmm.
where they're like hatching this grand plan. You know, then you cut away to Cersei and Jaime. The very next scene, you got Davos in King's Landing. All right, fine. All right, you fast forwarded it, and then in the same episode, you had him go back to Dragonstone,
mm-hmm.
and then go up to the wall. If you had no map in your head, it maybe isn't an issue, but here's the other thing about this. Part of what I love about this show...
We see the map every time.
Yeah, part of what I've loved about this show is that it tries to be realistic about the limitations of the characters. And for instance, like in episode 2 of the entire series, like season 1, episode 2... Robert and Ned are on their way on the King's Road, and they're heading down to King's Landing. It just takes a while to get places.
Mm-hmm.
And because it takes a while to get places, chaos happens, right?
Yeah, right.
Little kids get into fights, and then wolves get involved, and it sets these wars in motion.
Right.
Right? Or Jaime and Brienne can't get to King's Landing fast enough, and it results in Jaime losing a hand. And so, or, for instance... It takes a while to go from point A to point B on a ship. And guess what? Euron may be in the middle of point A and point B. So there's a lot of the plot that happens on the road. And in this episode, it felt like, forget all the roads. We've got a DeLorean here. And we're just going to zip around as if there's no problem. So, I mean, it may seem like an odd thing because I really love all the characters and I really like all of the exchanges and I laughed out loud a couple times and I get to be in the world of Game of Thrones, which is, you know, one of my favorite little fantasy lands to visit. But part of what makes me like the little fantasy excursion is the way that they've constructed the world and now they're breaking their own rules.
Yeah, no, I agree because it was... You'd expect this kind of movement from the A-Team.
Well, there was a little A-Team vibe at the end of this episode.
And I would say that definitely, it a lot felt rushed. Like it just, and to your point, it's, well, so everyone's just chilling while they're making their way to all these different places. Because that's what it feels, because I mean, to get to get to go back to the Tyrion to Bronn thing, in order to make that happen, time has to take place. There has to be a correspondence, which I guess involves birds. And
yeah.
And so you got to send it out. You got to get the agreement. You got, and then, and then you, then you get them there. And it's like, and also I'm just kind of like, I know there's been some turnover in King's Landing.
Yeah.
But like,
they're not sure it's Tyrion. Like,
right. I'm like, for one thing, what? It'd be one thing if every time we see King's Landing, it's just peppered with dwarves.
The other thing is that I think it's like there's a general cultural rule that you come up with your two stupidest guys, and those are the people you put on guard.
Yeah.
Like, every season we've had this issue.
Yeah.
Like, the person who's guarding your most important asset is probably your stupidest guy.
Right. Well, right. So, and also, like I said, I mean, it's not like if Tyrion was like dressed in rags or something, you might go, it's another one of them poor dwarves. But like, here comes a little regal dwarf. How many of these are there in the entire kingdom?
We did see an actor dwarf, and he could dress up like Tyrion,
right? But... and they would have just cut his head off on principle. That's what they've been doing. Supposedly, right. Find a dwarf, kill a dwarf. That's what Cersei wants. And keep in mind, and again, I understand this is not what the show has taken it, but I'm like, if this were in the book, hey, that platinum blonde dwarf with no nose,
yeah. That's probably Tyrion.
I wonder if he knows Tyrion.
All right. I don't want to belabor this point, but I do want to make it does relate to the major plot of this episode and the rest of the season. So Jon gets a raven from Bran and says, "The Night King is on the move. Come as quick as you can." I mean, I'm assuming that's what the raven says, right? Yeah. Because John's got this huge sense of urgency, like, I gotta go. Like, you gotta let me go. I'm going back north. And we're gonna fight with whatever men we have, right? It just seems like this is so urgent, he's prepared to just fight and lose.
Right.
And then Tyrion hatches a plan that requires them to make an alliance with Cersei. But before they make an alliance with Cersei,
any proof?
They need to do a little expedition north of the wall. Well, what Tyrion is suggesting here, and no one in the room apparently is smart enough to point this out, is like, oh, well, Tyrion, your plan's going to take like 5 months.
Yeah.
And here, John wants to like go fight right now. And then John just is completely turned around by it because he's thinking, well, more armies, maybe I can make this happen. And I'm thinking, okay, well, that's a long road, but maybe, you know, maybe I should just trust that they're these storytellers. But by the end of the episode, that expedition is north of the wall.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And so it's sort of like, well, if the point here was urgency, then how are you, and this episode is supposed to span like months, then why is John think that this is going to work anyway? The timing is an issue. And the other thing is that, is this a great plan to show Cersei a zombie?
I guess that, I think that was my bigger thing. I'm like, okay, you want to essentially create a truth, which is what I've been talking about the whole time, which is like, I've always felt like at some point the threat from beyond the wall has to unite everybody, but I never necessarily saw it as like this, like a planned unification. I saw it more as a, oh crap. Like I envisioned from a narrative perspective, like it would have, I mean, who am I to quibble, but I mean, or suggest, but I mean, I was always like, I went back to the Stannis would team up with Jon. It would fight Ramsay. Then the White Walkers would show up, and then now they all have to turn their attention like mid battle, right? Then like they can stave them off, but then now there's like that's where the troops come from. Like they staved off a bit of them and said, okay, look, we've got to right now.
But this is something of a parallel, right?
So it's something of a parallel, but without the immediacy, right? So that's the thing, is for me, that was the only way to get people to believe. I mean, I do agree, right? Like, so I think Tyrion's plan is actually what I'm saying is, like, in order for them, anybody, to combine forces, they have to see the evidence firsthand. But this is a very convoluted way to get there. I understand if they just went and fought the White Walkers, and then, mm-hmm. you know, the King's Landing people, yeah, we'll just let them die and we'll just wait it out. I mean, mm-hmm. like, that's also something. It isn't until it's an imminent threat to King's Landing, and I still don't know that. I just don't know if it's would be Cersei's character to be like, oh, hey, look, here's a zombie. Like, all right, fine. She doesn't strike me as anybody who cares about
that. Yeah, you're really, aside from the pacing and the timing issues, the chronology, you're really, I mean, you imagine, we want to believe Tyrion's a really smart guy, right? So, man, he's putting a lot of eggs in that Cersei basket.
And I don't think that, and it doesn't sound like that's based on it. Because I guess, and yeah, I would see Tyrion doing that if he was to be like, oh crap, I saw a White Walker. Guys, this is the real deal. We got to get Cersei. Sure. Like to the point where he feels a sense of urgency that it might even betray some of his strategic thinking. This is his strategic thinking to go, oh, well, we'll just show Cersei this. And it's like, Cersei is pretty much feels like a nihilist at this point. Cersei feels like she is just, look, I'll die on this throne.
This is the person that just blew up an entire public space.
Her public space.
And probably murdered 100 people that she had no feelings for whatsoever. Just to get at the 3 people that she wanted dead.
Right.
So you're putting a lot of eggs in that. In a basket that may be a little bit psychopathic.
Right. Yeah. So, you're trying to reason. I mean, and so just any idea of a truce right now just seems so far-fetched.
Now, I could see, if I was going to think about it from Tyrion's perspective, it could be that, all right, Tyrion's maybe not convinced that there's an undead army, but he kind of likes the idea of unifying the North and the North with Dany's cause.
Mm-hmm.
And so maybe Tyrion's thinking, if this is what it takes to get these two together, these two crazy kids together,
right,
then we're going to do a little zombie meet cute north of the wall or something.
Right.
To make sure that I kind of nudge these two along because I really need this alliance or something like that. But
you can't do recon on a dragon. You can't just don't go down, just fly above.
All right. I really loved there's so much I loved about this episode. The Jaime Tyrion reunion. I mean, it's such a complicated relationship between those two. You know, I almost got the sense that with Jaime, when he said, I said I'd cut you in half, like he was really thinking about it. And then, you know, Tyrion, of course, kind of turns that conversation toward a joke. And I think that kind of reminds Jaime, like, why he loves Tyrion in the first place. And he, you know, he's pissed off at him and he maybe hates him, but he still loves him. Yeah. Just a lot of complexity there that this show does really well.
Yeah. And then Tyrion has his, like, you know, like he tries to appeal to him as a brother. I didn't want to be made this way, blah, blah, blah. And then Jaime just cuts him off. And I think that was kind of, that was effective, I thought, where Tyrion sees him sort of shift a little bit, like, okay, he recognizes that I'm the brother. And so then he wants to have a brotherly conversation, but then Jaime cuts it off. And I think that's an important dynamic because Jaime's all in on this whole Cersei thing, and he has to be, and he's always conflicted when he's away from Cersei. It's like some sort of like, you know, his kryptonite is anything away from Cersei.
Uh-huh.
And so he's trying to cling. That kind of scene is effective, but I still was like, oh, that was pretty quick how we got there. And it seemed like there was a lot of those, right? A lot of those, well, okay, this is good, but all right, I have to sort of suspend that. When I'm looking for suspension of certain, suspension of disbelief and all that, I could do that with some of the magic, but then But like to your point, these are all logistical realities that the show has prioritized up until this point. Mm-hmm. And you can't, and if you change the rules on them, on us, then the rules that I've grown accustomed to are now all so flexible that I'm like, well, now the risk is run that you can just bend your way out of everything. Because we're already doing that. I mean, this episode was probably the most egregious, again, when it comes to the timing. And then, like Heather's big thing was like, well, did you really think Arya would fall for Littlefinger with all that she's been trained for? Like, I mean,
well, okay.
So that was a discussion because it was,
I actually like that. I like the idea that Littlefinger is actually pretty good at this too. It's like Arya is spying, and then part of me thought, why not use a face? Like, if you're spying,
sure, that's what I was thinking.
Use a face. I mean, I guess you probably have to walk around as Walder Frey or whatever. It's not like she has unlimited faces.
Yeah, I thought about that
satchel.
Too. Like, she gotta slice one of the people that she's like supposedly friendly with.
Yeah. So, but I do like the idea. I did like the idea that okay, Littlefinger's so good that even with Arya's all of Arya's training,
and she's also young. I mean, that's the other thing.
She's young, and she doesn't know how good he is. He's so good that he's actually spying on the person who's spying on him.
Mm-hmm.
He's been doing this for a while, man. I mean, and you know, all that time she was trained with the sword and all of that business.
Yeah,
hanging out with the acting troupe. Littlefinger's been doing nothing but conniving.
Right,
like, that's what he does. Right, so I do like the idea that he's. He's still pretty formidable. Now, if he was doing this with Bran, I'd have a different I'd have a different issue.
Sure. Yeah, and I don't know. And maybe I think part of that too is just like Littlefinger is effectively frustrating in the show, mm-hmm. and then as somebody you're watching, you're just like it's like you reach. I feel like I'm reaching. You're sort of reaching my bandwidth on. Mm-hmm. On little, because like Littlefinger, and again, I think this is, and maybe it's juxtaposed to the pacing, or at least the rule breaking of timing on the show. Like they really like Littlefinger is a long game player, and so they play him out with the long game, and so you only get complications, very little resolution. So that tension juxtaposed.
Well, he's a chaos agent too. I think it's like. Yeah, he's not really sure what the end game is going to be, but he knows if he throws a wrench into the works, something crazy is going to happen, and then he'll kind of decide like the various possibilities that are most advantageous to him once everyone else is reeling. Right?
If he wants to be on the throne, then the main goal is to make sure nobody else is in a position to get it.
Sure.
So if you can do that, I mean, that's easy.
Like Vera said, like if he could actually be on the throne, he does not mind ruling over the ashes.
Right. And that's the whole thing about the chaos is the latter concept, right? It's like, mm-hmm. look, I sow this chaos and then it as it takes care of itself, I take a next step up. All right, now what? Do I have to sow more chaos? That's fine. Mm-hmm. I need to be able to create the chaos, stand back from it, overcome it, and then whatever, you know, it just lays waste to whatever, like, if
sure.
And so that makes sense to me, right? I mean, that, and I think that that's been still he's an effective foil for the progress of the show, and that's, but I think the reason why I might have been a little bit less patient with him and the chaos sowing in this episode is because I think it all does come back to the fact that everything else was on fast forward. So meanwhile, everything else is like, yep, and we go here, and we go here, and then we go here, and then everybody agrees. Okay, fine. On to the next thing. Everybody agrees. Okay, fine. Hey, this guy's an enemy. Not today. On to the next thing. And meanwhile, he's lurking, and I'm like, well, I got lurking over here at a very slow pace, and I'm like, did he do this?
Well, and that's
over 5 months that everybody's been doing the other stuff.
See, that's the chaos problem that I'm starting to feel because. All right, so you established this rule early on about getting from point A to point B is actually kind of difficult. And now you're breaking that rule, and just breaking one of these little rules, you don't know the consequences. So, I mean, maybe the consequence for all of the fast-forwarding in these other scenes means that the scene with Littlefinger lands differently than it would have otherwise.
Right.
even though it has really nothing to do with that scene, it's where your headspace is when you receive the scene. So I don't know. All right. So a couple things that I thought were hilarious. Tyrion tells Jorah, nobody glowers like you.
Yeah, that was great.
I was laughing hard at that one. Sam and Gilly, Sam's a great actor sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
Most of the time, he's a great actor. And seeing Sam, who's generally pretty gregarious, get really annoyed at Maester Maynard or whatever, mm-hmm. who's documenting all of his many shits throughout the year.
So funny.
It's great. And they're actually delivering some really crucial information through that scene, right? This whole business about her asking, what's an annulment? And seems like someone named Rhaegar got an annulment.
Right, right.
And then Sam is like, he's not hearing it because he's just pissed off.
Yeah, I like that because
no one sees the bigger picture.
Yeah,
because
I'm sitting there listening to it. I'm like, annulment? Oh, Rhaegar, wait a minute. You know, and again, I'm not great at putting all this together historically, but I'm like, this is now all starting to, like, the pieces are starting to at least get on. I feel like,
well, I love that he's pissed off at them because they can't see the big picture. And here Gilly's giving him like a huge puzzle piece. And he's just pissed off about Maester Maynard or whatever.
Right. It's 15,782 shits. Steps.
So that was really effective.
That was great. It was that. And then Sam just is like, he's over it. And I thought that was pretty cool. I like the line, you know, I'm tired of, was it like documenting or reading the stories of Better Man or whatever it was.
Right. Reading about the achievements of Better Man. Yeah. I think that's, what was that? His father's line?
I believe so. And so that was great.
Sam never finds out that his dad and brother are killed.
No,
right?
It's explicitly said by the Archmaester.
And then you get the sense of like, okay, he's leaving. He's leaving at night. No one's going to be able to tell him this information.
Yeah. Yeah. So, they just said they'd keep it from him for the moment anyway. And this is another, so Heather just realized when that was said that she didn't make the connection that Dickon and Randall were, that was them.
Oh.
She's like, right. Wait.
Well, it doesn't help that the actors have changed.
Right. She's like, well, wait. What?
At least one
she's,
of them.
She's like, what happened to his family? I'm like, well, they just got cooked by the dragon. He's like, wait, that was them? And I was like, yeah, that was them all. And I felt bad because I was like, oh, I would have helped make that connection. She's like, well, that makes all that more interesting. I was like, who's this old guy? And I said, I understand. There's a bunch of, she's like, yeah, a bunch of haggard old white guys. They're everywhere.
Yeah.
So,
well,
yeah. So that was,
that's why you don't switch actors.
Yeah.
Because that can throw people off.
Right. And so, yeah, Dickon, we hardly knew you. Not to just sit there and just crap on all the problems, but the problems were a little more problematic, but there was some real good stuff. I really like the Tyrion advising. Like I like when he turns his back, like there's something very well presented about the way he has his back to the crowd to kind of tell her, you know, maybe we don't need to cook everybody. And then she's like, I'm gonna cook everybody. All right. And then he's like, And so he'd reached dragon fatigue at this point. Yeah. And
well, it's one of his chief concerns, right?
Right.
It's like, are you your father?
Right. And that's what both of their tensions are. Are you still a Lannister? As far as I see Lannisters, and he's like, are you still a Targaryen? As far as I see Targaryens. And so there is I think that tension, as long as that tension keeps going, I think that's really valuable. And I think it's necessary because there's tension you feel when it looks like a hound is going to eat somebody. It's the tension you feel when a White Walker is dragging his way, but there's another tension you feel when you see two people that should work together, but it's just not like they haven't fully meshed because there's so much baggage and the distrust. Right. And this is what, you know, Littlefinger has said, and it has borne fruit throughout, is like, trust is a luxury that many can't afford, because trust and, seems like it's traded at any given at any given sequence based on and I think Varys is a classic example of that. Even Varys, who kind of seemed,
I was just gonna say, like, Tyrion again with the middle management theme. Tyrion is there telling Dany, like, look, you gotta be better than this. You can't, don't go crazy on me. You know, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
Don't go all psycho on me. And then he turns around and then he becomes an apologist to Varys, right? I mean, it's classic. It's a classic kind of thing where, like, you have to manage up with Dany and then you kind of have to defend her bad decisions to Varys. And it's not working in either direction, really.
Yeah, no, agree. It's the Varys Tyrion interaction is great. I like that, all that tension. I'm willing to just kind of go, okay, that's fine. We're not too worried about the time sequence. I don't know, and that's where I guess the confusion that I have is: did this take 5 months, or did it not take 5 months? How long did it take? Because
no, we don't really know. Like, that's right. So let's say I'm thinking, let's say I want to give the showrunners the benefit of the doubt that they actually know the map in their head. Right.
Right.
And I think, okay, well, this is an episode that takes 5 months. We're seeing it span 5 months. And then I think, boy, it didn't feel like 5 months. They could have made it feel like a longer period of time. There are tricks that you can do with, I don't know, facial hair and montages and spacing out scenes better.
Right.
And normally what they'll do is they'll, like, someone will leave one episode and you won't see them for an episode. And then two episodes later, they arrive where they said they were going to go. And it's a little trick that you pull because the audience is like, oh yeah, they must have been traveling the whole time. And it wasn't eventful, and so they got to their destination. But when it's only a scene that's separating all of this fast forwarding, it feels like you're playing fast and loose.
Yeah, and because so much else could have happened in King's Landing and Winterfell during that time frame, when you see the back and forth that goes on there, and Littlefinger doing his skulking, and then Arya and Sansa having their, and like, well, wow, were those months of her following Littlefinger? you know,
this cat and mouse game has just gone on forever.
Right. So that's what you start thinking. It's like, well, while they're going to the wall, I mean, like, yeah, there's a lot of ground that was covered other places, and a very slow,
got like a walker.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's like following him every day for 5 months. I would expect, I know he plays the long game, but 5 months, I feel like he would have already done more damage.
You know what makes me think? It makes me think the showrunners don't really care about the hardcore fans at this point. They're thinking they're kind of assuming a certain level of, like, I don't want to say lack of intelligence, but I think that in past seasons, the showrunners have assumed a certain amount of intelligence from their fans. And be like, well, we can't do that because too many hardcore fans are going to notice that this is going to be a problem. But I kind of feel like with this one is like, just give them some action sequences and some intrigue, and they won't notice. They won't notice all the details. And at that point, I think, well, then you don't care about your most avid fans at that point. I don't know if that's a good business model.
Well, yeah, and you are moving towards the end. That's the problem too. So you have to start asking, like, well, are they aware of this issue? And you have to assume that they are, because it was something that was a priority for them earlier.
Well, here's the other thing: why do you need an 80-minute episode?
True.
Like, you decided to do a truncated season, but then you made some of the episodes 80 minutes long. Several of them, like five of them, 80 minutes long. So if you just made them all 50 minutes long and gave me 9 episodes this season, you could have paced this out in a way that isn't taking me.
Yeah, and that's where I think it gets a little. It feels a little wonky, right?
It's like an unforced error. Like, why?
Yeah.
Why do it?
So, and you mentioned before. Hey, look, these guys are getting Star Wars offers. These guys are getting, you know, other series offers. These guys are the kings of the world, right?
Yeah, and they've given a decade of their life to this project, and it's kind of like,
and they're playing.
They have a little senioritis.
I think there's that. That they're playing now. They're playing without actual text. They, you know, we're talking rough outlines. They're trying to fill in the blanks.
And
I think that, you know, in their defense, they can still be really good and creative showrunners.
They've shown it. They've absolutely
right. And so, and then you say, well, you know, but they only, you know, some people say, well, they only need, they, if without the text, they're kind of lost. I'm like, well, sure. I mean, yeah. Because the thing is that.
But most of season six was not. I mean, a lot of season six departed from the text.
But what we don't.
And yeah. it was really good.
Right. But what we don't know is about, like, now you're headed towards an end game. And if Martin had written the end game and then they were required to fill in the pre stuff, that's easier because the first off, you're not on the hook for the ending as much. If anybody has an objection with how you ended, I mean, well, hey, you go talk to Martin. So they're already in a bad spot, right?
Yeah,
because the ending is now, we care more about, as the journey goes on, you care more about the ending than how we got there.
Yeah,
there,
sure,
right?
Sure.
And so they have all this.
Or, great... I mean, one point that you could make is, look, you just edit it a little bit better and I won't have these issues.
Right.
You know?
Well, yeah. And so that's now. And so here's the question, right? So I guess the way I was going to go with that is, let's say they the whole thing was an outline, right? And the previous six seasons had the sort of pacing that we see in this episode.
Yeah.
I think we forgive it. Right? I think we forgive it because it's what we're used to. And I don't think we would be sitting here going, well, these guys don't know what they're doing when it comes to this, that, or whatever. And I don't say we're doing that, but I think that there's more of that.
Yeah, we've been trained to really love Tyrion's mind, right? And then he comes up with this plan to steal a zombie and show it to Cersei, and then you're thinking, but wait a second. I thought part of why I liked you is because you're super smart, and I don't think this is going to work.
Well, and I'm kind of also in the boat that says, if you have Dany on your side with dragons and Dothraki and all that, how much more helpful is Cersei and her army?
Well, that's the point. Dany won't go north. Because that gives Cersei all of the Southern Kingdoms.
Sure, okay.
Cersei will take control. But if Dany stays in the South, then she can continue to advance, right?
But if Cersei...
So she doesn't want to create a vacuum.
So if Cersei and them do not... If they're not moving anywhere...
Yeah, if they can get a peace... If they can get a peace agreement...
More than anything, they're putting a pause on Cersei.
But even then, it's like, okay, let's say you do have a peace agreement. Do you think that Cersei's going to honor the peace agreement?
That's the other part of it, is what you're trusting somebody who's probably the least trustworthy outside of Littlefinger.
I liked Tormund at the Wall. I thought he was... I just love Tormund.
Yeah.
There's just so much about Tormund that I mean, the whole... He's, you know, just a point of clarification. Like, wait, there's two queens... And wait, you have to. Which one do you have to convince? The one with the dragons, or the one that's fucking her?
Yeah, that was great. No, and you know, and I again, there is a lot in this episode that's good, and it keeps me interested, and it keeps me moving. But there were, you know, especially after that last episode, this is the one that had the most. Okay, I guess.
Well, it's so crazy because that last episode, you were like, I would put this up against any episode in Game of Thrones. That was fantastic.
Yeah,
and then you follow it up with, and you know what? I think that episode was great. And I think that this episode could have been great too. It's just a few unforced errors, and it kind of took me out of it.
I think you could have gotten away with having more journey for Davos and Jon. In fact, actually make that a little bit less of the focus and do some of the Littlefinger machinations have the Sam moment, all that stuff would work. Like, again, if you just cut this thing down to a 50-minute episode.
Then
I honestly think you can get away with moving the Hound discovery in the middle of the next episode, if that's how it had to land. Because I don't feel like that was as big of a deal as the other things at that point. I mean, again, very Davos heavy, very almost comically so. Think about Davos.
Yeah,
because I think
he's got moves, man. He knows just how to use a little bit of fermented crab. As a smuggler, Davos has got to be pretty clever. But if you think about the intelligence level of the usual guard in this world, you have to wonder, like, are you good, or are you just kind of...
If you just know where the dumbest ports are. I feel like one could have probably talked his way out of the interaction with the guard.
The last scene where the team of unlikely allies are moving north of the wall, it was very Fellowship of the Ring to me.
Yeah.
It was kind of like, okay, you're on a quest. There's going to be lots of danger. And you're going up against, the evil lord. And your team is made up of this hodgepodge group of people that wouldn't normally find themselves together.
Yeah.
Right. And so I don't know. I mean, maybe it was a conscious homage, but that definitely felt, Fellowship of the Ring, or I don't know, Fellowship of the Thing.
Yeah.
I like the idea that, like, the Hound and Tormund are going to be, like, palling it up. You know, there's just so much possibility.
Oh, yeah.
Like, he just threw all kinds of different chemicals together, and now you're going to see what the reaction
is. Yeah, no, and I think that, I'm very interested in what's going to happen next. It's not the problem. This is where, like, again, as you start to get concerned, as I know the inevitable wheels fall off this thing.
Mm-hmm.
And again, I don't know how or,
Well, you're starting to see the seeds of chaos.
So right. And that's the kind of thing where I'm like, as soon as I've interrupted my viewing to go, but okay. It's already a concern. And so what I'm trying to do.
Well, at least part of your dream came true, Steve.
That's true.
It's not too late for the rest of it to come true.
No, that's very true. I'm at this point now where I'm like, can I recalibrate? Because we started talking about the ending
I think
tonight.
If Dorne is any indication, it's like, well, a couple really good episodes could bring you right back in.
Right. And so I'm trying, so as the expectations get tempered, and again, I'm still having the struggle between, like, how bad can it be? I can't wait. It's the, okay, when do I start making the adjustment? When do I start to and this was a good episode for me to sort of go, okay, look, let me see is this the time where I start to shift the expectation and, like I said, recalibrate my engagement in the show? Because that, I think, is an important aspect. It's because when I buckle into this, I'm like, here we go. And I get lost a lot of times. I didn't get as lost in this one because there was a lot of moments where I am taking a step back, or I'm hitting pause and asking a question. Mm-hmm. But I'm still very much interested. So I'm like, okay, how can I mine the, I'm still very interested, let's see where we're going, and start to divorce myself from the other nuances that I loved so much. The problem is, I did love those nuances a lot. And if those nuances are starting to fade, or they're becoming jumbled.
And I think that there's more to come. There's more of those new, I mean, they're like I said before, I think that there's going to be moments that remind you that, oh yeah, that's a great Game of Thrones moment. Mm-hmm. I really like that. And you just kind of hope that the other stuff doesn't take you out so much that you can't appreciate those moments.
No, and I think that that's key. And I think that's probably why I liked the last episode so much, is because as soon as season 7 started, there's a lot of assonance. I was preparing to downshift. I'm like, all right, I don't think I'm going to, here it comes, right? And then the first 4 episodes I thought were really great. I mean, there were some, some pacing issues, some fast forward issues, but for the most part, I thought those, I'm like, I'm all, I, I'll put these four episodes up against anything in five, and I liked five despite the Dorn. Yeah. You know what I mean? So I was already like, so I tempered the expectations, and all of a sudden I'm like, this is actually, I think, good even without the tempering. And then this one came, and this is, and so now I'm like, oh, is this the beginning? And that's where I'm kind of like, so it's, again, there's two shows I'm watching. There's the show that I'm engaged in, and then there's the overall, how is this going to fall apart show that I'm trying to watch. And I'm interested in both. And so it's a very weird spot to be in, because I haven't been in this spot before. So I'm equally excited, but then I'm like, well, I don't want to get so involved in the, well, let's look at what falls apart that I'm now looking solely.
Yeah. The worst thing that could happen for you is if it's kind of middle of the road.
Totally.
Then you're disappointed in two ways.
Yeah. My biggest fear is that the show engagement becomes kind of mediocre, and it's like, oh, okay, that's all right. And then, the ending is like, that's fine. To me, if I walk out of this thing going, no, everything was fine. It's like, you know how I feel about comedy. I want to see great comedy, or I want to see real bad comedy. The worst thing is boring comedy.
Here are the highlights coming up this week on Bald Move.
We've got lots of ongoing coverage this week, from book versus show comparisons for Hot D to the latest very special episode of Why Is Mr. Feeny a Car? But there are a couple of main events this week you need to know about.
Firstly, we've got a brand new commission podcast out this Tuesday, covering The Raid 2, sometimes subtitled Retaliation. If you're a fan of martial arts films, this is one you don't want to miss. Iko Uwe is a rising star in the action movie world, and it's easy to see why. Join us on Tuesday as we dive into the bigger, badder sequel to The Raid, try and figure out which is better.
Then on Thursday, we're covering the season finale of Hulu's excellent period drama, Shogun. We've been waiting all season to see what Toranaga-sama's plan is, or if he even has one. It all comes down to this, and we couldn't be more excited. Join us on Thursday for what's sure to be an epic Shogun season finale podcast, and to find out if we plan to cover any related materials.
You find these and many other great podcasts by searching for Bald Move Pulp or Bald Move Prestige in your favorite podcast app. We're getting geared up for the 6th annual Summer Badass Fest. And while we're working on a slate of apex badass films to enjoy, we've got an early action-packed announcement to make.
Just like last year, we're kicking off Badass Season with a live movie watch and podcast recording. We've rented out a theater for connoisseurs of action films and Bald Move fans that just want to have a great time.
Unlike last year, this year's movie is top secret. Hush, hush. No hints, except it's incredibly badass. It stars an absolute icon of the genre. We're willing to bet most of you haven't seen it, and it's going to be an incredible viewing experience with a packed house of Bald Movers.
Those of you who came to last year's screening of Total Recall know what a party it was. And those of you who didn't, now's your chance to experience it. Meet me and Jim, order some custom movie-themed drinks at the theater's full bar, then watch us record the full podcast for the movie. We reserved a venue over twice the size as last year, but seating is still limited.
It's happening Friday, June 21st at 7 p.m. in our hometown of Cincinnati. Get full details and buy tickets at baldmove.com/live.
Cincinnati's actually a pretty great city to visit, and we've got lots of details for side adventures on our event page as well. The Reds are playing the Boston Red Sox in their fantastic Riverside Stadium. The thrills of Kings Island just minutes away, and I'll be leading a kayak trip down the scenic Little Miami River on Saturday.
Again, get full details and get your tickets now on our Badass Fest 6 page at baldmove.com/live.
Hey, it's time for another season of Why Is Mr. Feeny a Car? The premise is simple. A Gen Xer and a millennial watch old 80s action TV to see what still works and what doesn't. In previous seasons, we've done podcasts for Knight Rider, Airwolf, MacGyver, A-Team, and more. However, this year we're doing a very special season of Feeny. We're going back and reviewing the very special episodes of 80s and 90s sitcoms. Come cringe along with us as Hollywood tries to warn our families of the dangers of underage smoking, drug abuse, alcoholism, eating disorders, and much more. We start out with the episode of Boy Meets World where a high school kid gets sucked into a cult. Worlds collide as the Mr. Feeny finally makes an appearance on Why Is Mr. Feeny a Car? Join me and my buddy Jay each week for episodes full of nostalgia and secondhand embarrassment. And don't worry, if very special isn't your speed, we've also got some all-time classic Knight Rider episodes to close the season with. Find Why Is Mr. Feeny a Car? Each Wednesday on Bald Move Pulp, starting April 3rd. We're about 10 weeks out from House of the Dragon Season 2, and it's time to prepare for war.
Which in our case means, well, watching a lot of Hot D and reading a lot of Fire and Blood.
Each week between now and June 16th, Maester Anthony and his co-host Steve are hosting a watch of each episode of Hot D Season 1. And then me and Jim are going to host a discussion of the differences between the events on that episode and how they're recounted in George R.R. Martin's historical tome, Fire and Blood.
That's right, I've resorted to reading dragon books. God help us all. We'll see if my fresh eyes add any new insights or predictions into Season 2.
Arm yourselves with all the lore you can for the battles ahead. House of the Dragon returns June 16th, but we've got you covered until then.
Check out all of our upcoming Hot D coverage on the Hot D feed or on Bald Move Pulp, available wherever you listen to podcasts. FX is adapting James Clavell's best-selling novel, Shogun, into a 10-part miniseries this spring. Set in the shogunate period of Japan at the turn of the 15th century, Shogun depicts the rise of a feudal lord to Shogun, as seen through the eyes of a shipwrecked English sailor. It's loosely based on the real-life exploits of William Adams and Tokugawa Ieyasu.
Shogun has already been successfully adapted back in 1980 with a widely acclaimed miniseries starring Richard Chamberlain. Featuring intricate plots, political scheming, complex characters, and thrilling action. This time, husband and wife team Justin Marks and Rachel Kondo try to recapture the successes of the novel and early adaptations, while increasing the levels of historical and cultural accuracy that are often perceived as flaws of this and similar works.
Starring Hiroyuki Sanada from The Last Samurai, Mortal Kombat, and John Wick 4, with Cosmo Jarvis of Peaky Blinders, Raised by Wolves, etc., joining the truly massive cast required to bring this complex world to life. Join Aaron and I each week as we deep dive into each episode, uncovering the mysteries, the intrigue, and the glory of Shogun.
Shogun premieres on FX Hulu Tuesday, February 27th, with a two-part debut. Our podcast will release each Thursday thereafter. Get our Shogun coverage by searching for Bald Move Prestige in your favorite podcast app.
I sort of default to a close reading, so it's like I do my best to keep my mind bifurcated so that I can enjoy. I think that's maybe why I can enjoy this book and not be angry at Martin. I get angry emails, not angry at me, but angry at Martin. I just got one the other day. It was like, you know, calling Martin a fat asshole or something like that because he won't finish. I'm thinking, well, come on now. That's, I mean, of course, I get angry sometimes too, but I can kind of push that to one side so I can enjoy the text in front of me.
I just love the fact that you started this by saying how your idea of this podcast is to be a love letter to Martin's work, and then this person. Mm-hmm. Sent an email the exact opposite of exactly.
Yeah, no, there is part of me that feels like if I can convince myself, maybe I'm trying to fool myself. If I can convince myself that this book is a gift, even if there were no sequels, and enjoy it in that way, then maybe I can sort of lean toward my better angels. But you know, maybe it's just for my own benefit that I'm doing it. I don't know.
I think, like, would you recommend this book series to someone new? Knowing that they're going to be frustrated at the end.
Yes, absolutely. In the same way that I would recommend watching Godfather Part 1 and 2 to people. You know, if you want to experience one of the greatest films ever made, you should watch The Godfather. It's one of the greatest films ever made. And then it very well could be that the second movie is even better than the first. And you might want to experience that too. And then I would say, it's probably wise to stop there, right? So I think that, and I'm happy to do that with the Game of Thrones. And I don't mind also saying, like, but you just have to appreciate it for what it is and not necessarily be hell-bent on finding some sort of resolution. But I don't know. Let me ask you a different question.
Mm-hmm.
When you're watching movies, sometimes there'll be sort of an open-ended movie where it's like you get to the end of it and you're like, yeah, but you didn't tell me what really happened. You're leaving it up to me to figure out, like, what I think happened. Some people really don't like movies like that. Some people would rather like there to be like a little bow at the end so that you have some closure with the narrative. And then some movies are like, well, now it's up to you, interpreter. You know, it's up to you to figure out how to read this ending. Which kind of movie do you like?
This is a very embarrassing question, because you know how they say that your brain isn't fully formed until you're like 21?
Yeah.
24, something like that.
Something like that.
I believe the part of my brain that has maturity to understand that what's on TV is not in the real world when it comes to intrigue has not formed yet. It's coming, but it's not here yet. And it's very embarrassing when I watch films.
This is not, no, you can't use this as an excuse. Because if you're mature enough to reflect upon your own age in this way, then you're absolutely mature. You're absolutely mature enough to answer the question.
So when I watch a thriller, you do know Snowpiercer, great thriller series, right?
Are you talking about the television show or the movie?
The television show.
Yeah, I've watched two or three seasons, something like that.
So I was watching it with someone else, and I don't often watch series with other people. And I realized that I cannot watch a thriller series without skipping about 30% of it. Because I can't handle the stress and I want to get to the end of the thriller sequence. So I guess that answers the question. I want to know if there's at least anyone that is like me and that could not admit it because it's too embarrassing. Please send an email and we can create a Facebook group.
No, I feel like I would recommend these books to people who are interested in, you know, good political fiction.
Mm-hmm.
Or good fantasy. I think, I mean, even people that are sort of open to sci-fi, I think should be open to this book as well.
Mm-hmm.
I wouldn't recommend it to everyone. Like, for instance, like, my wife's not into this book at all. But I think my daughter would be. So, anyway, I mean, it just depends. Different books for different people, I suppose. But the fact that we will never see A Dream of Spring would not hinder me from recommending the book.
Okay. Very well. Fair enough. I was just saying, because my sister, when I started the book, told me you got to be ready to be okay with it not ending. And I had to make peace with that before I started.